Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We are on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots. Good afternoon, Lindsay. How are you?
Good afternoon, Peter. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just back from... I wasn't nominated for anything, but they invited me back to the Guild of Food Writer Awards.
Ooh, and very nice.
I think I'm still hungover. I was speaking to one of the organizers and she was saying, we always try to make sure that it feels very generous. And by generous, they mean trays and trays of cocktails and people walking around with bottles of wine. So as soon as you nearly empty a glass. It was also the warmest day. It was like that really hot one on Thursday. And we were in a historic building without air conditioning. So we were just thirsty in general. It was a really bad combination for for a bunch of like foodies to be networking. But anyway, yes, I am delighted to be back in Scotland and ready today to talk with Sam Bilton.
Yes, I imagine you'll have bumped into Sam down at the awards as well.
I think we both bumped into each other quite literally because we were both enjoying the trays of sherry cocktails. No, yes. I first met Sam through her podcast. She invited us to speak, to come on to speak about the history of Black Bun. Was that your first meeting with Sam?
I think I'd spoken to her previously. I kind of came across her through Neil Buttery's podcast and an episode she'd done with him, and then I'd come across her books, but that was the first time we'd sort of spoken, and then the wonderful internet just does its community thing, so
yeah,
come together across Instagram, and Sam actually joined us at our Scottish Food Heritage Symposium earlier this year, did a wonderful talk about gingerbread, which is going to be the subject of today's episode.
Yes, so we're going to get Sam on in a moment, and we're going to have a wee chat about how Sam got into writing about food history and the work that she's working on just now, and then we're going to play a snippet from the Food Heritage Symposium. Last week we had 700 people listen to the Catherine Cranston keynote from Gorilla Pynchon.
Oh no.
Sorry, let me put respect on her name, Perilla Kinchin. And lots of positive feedback. So we thought we'll add another one on here, but invite Sam on to chat. So today we are joined by Sam Bilton. Sam is an author of The Philosophy of Chocolate, Fool's Gold, A History of British Saffron, and First Catch Your Gingerbread, which examines the history of gingerbread from ancient times down to the present day. Please welcome to the Scottish Food History Podcast, Sam Bilton. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us, Sam. And we should also say that Sam has a wonderful podcast herself, Comfortably Hungry, which recently won an award, the Fortnum & Mason Podcast Award.
Congratulations!
Yes, it was quite a surprise.
I know very they say awards aren't important. However, when you win one, it feels very important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say it doesn't feel very important at all. It feels amazing. I mean, obviously, to be there and up against two BBC programmes, which I keep telling people, up against two BBC programmes, and to win was a fabulous feeling. But I genuinely didn't think I was going to win. I was just thrilled to be shortlisted. So, yes, it was very special indeed.
I always think it's so nice when the kind of food history side of things gets recognised. It feels like a win for the whole community. So we're thrilled for it.
Definitely, yeah.
What's that? When one of us shines, we all shine. It's that.
Absolutely.
And actually, maybe that's a good place to start because food history in general is a relatively unrecognised category of food writing or food research. How did you navigate your way into becoming a food historian and beginning to write about it?
Well, I'm a bit of an accidental historian. I've always loved history.
Aren't we all?
And I've always loved food, but it took me a long time to marry the two. So I went back to university to do a master's after I had my second child, and it was in culinary arts. And I did that course because I wanted to be a food writer or have a deli. I quickly went off the idea of having a deli because I realised that actually that's a lot of hard work. Not that food history and food writing isn't hard work, but yeah, it takes a lot more investment, shall we say, from other concerned parties, namely my husband, who was basically like, yeah, I don't think we're going to go down the deli route. So I wanted to go into food writing, and I did enjoy, I did a bit of food writing, sort of general sort of local magazines, that sort of thing. And I did enjoy it, but I was finding increasingly that I was getting drawn back to history. So I'd done history at like A-level, and I've always had that interest in history and read around in my private life, I guess, read around history, historical subjects and whatnot. I decided that I would sort of nail my colours to the mast. And as I say, it sort of was sort of triggered by my grandmother giving me a copy of, it was an old beaten up copy of Mrs. Beaton's cookery book. Warden Locke, who owned the rights to Mrs. Beaton, produced her cookery, the recipe section, in various formats, and she had actually not one but two of these, one from I think 1911 and one from 1894. And inside that was a handwritten notebook by her, now you have to bear with me, her great aunt Eliza. I don't quite know what that makes Eliza to me, but it was, yeah, a long distance relative who had written while she was in service. It's a very slim notebook. I mean, it's not getting published as a cookbook in its own right, but it's a slim book of recipes that she'd obviously learned, I guess, while she was in service and decided to make a note of. And it just, that sort of triggered it, really. I was like, you know what, this is what I want to do. I want to investigate people like Great Aunt Eliza and foodways in the past. So I decided that was the route I was going to go down.
When you first started getting into food research, do you remember, was it like a first thing that you discovered that like reshaped your understanding of your own food, or when something you found where you think, am I the first person to have discovered this fact or to connect these things? Was there like a eureka moment that helped to spur you on?
Oh, I don't know that there was a eureka moment. I do know that I remember looking through one of my mum's old cookbooks. And when I say old, I mean, we're talking like from like the 60s or 70s. It wasn't like old like we used to see with, you know, like hundreds of years old. And there was a picture of a Tudor banquet. I mean, this is when I was a kid. And I do remember seeing that and going, cool, this must have been really cool to live in Tudor times and being able to eat roast swans. And then when you get to do this for a job, you realise that actually that maybe they did eat roast swans, but not everyone was eating roast swans. And actually the food that most people were eating was wildly different to what we actually see in a lot of cookbooks from that period and really up to the 20th century. I can't think of a pivotal, I'm sure there are some out there. But every time you read someone like Dorothy Hartley or Florence Wright, for example, there's certainly recipes. One of the things I love about food history is seeing these regional recipes that you may have got, that may be largely forgotten. I mean, we know some, and I know we're going to talk about regional recipes shortly, but, you know, sort of like there's a Sussex, in Sussex, there's an Ifield pudding, which is quite a bizarre concoction of sort of fruits, spices and meat, and then boiled and dried. And actually, I don't know anyone who makes Ifield pudding. Everyone talks about Sussex Pond pudding, and Sussex is supposedly renowned for puddings and all the rest of it. But yeah, it's things like that that really pique my interest, I guess.
Yeah, the sort of hidden things and the gaps. I love that when you're looking through historical cookbooks, whether they are handwritten, as you say, like notes in a cookbook, or whether it's those little snippets of newspaper clippings you find in cookbooks. And it almost feels like you're sort of doing a treasure hunt or some sort of like,
yes,
yeah, piecing together a puzzle or a mystery. That's always been one of the things that I love about food history, because there's always going to be gaps between what we find in cookbooks and recipes versus what people were actually cooking. And I love that even when you do the most diligent historical research, you can never really know if someone's adding a pinch of something without recording it.
No.
So there's a sort of slipperiness to food history, which I really enjoy because, yeah, people can change things as they go in the kitchen. But I think that's where the good stories are as well, when you see those adaptations or those little adjustments that people make.
I'm wondering, because actually I'm in this place right now where I am kind of feel like I'm straddling lines between being a food history writer and being called a food historian. I'm wondering, Sam, from history person to history person, when did you start to call yourself a food historian, and what do you think about the word, the phrase itself? Do you think you have to have a qualification, a level of experience, years in the trenches? What are your opinions on it?
I think that, and this is purely personal, I think that if you've got the passion for it and you're prepared to do the research, I think you can call yourself a historian. So for years I called myself a food writer who focused on food history. But then as to the point where I called myself food historian, probably around the time I published my first book, First Catch of Gingerbread, because I thought, well, actually, it's not the sort of thing a regular food writer would necessarily write, because it was quite in depth, obviously, study of gingerbreads in the UK. And it was also, it's quite geeky. I don't mind that. I mean, it is, call it what it is. It was a very geeky, very specialist book. So, yeah, I think we put an awful lot of weight on labels, don't we, I think, in society these days. We all have to be labelled with something. And I think if you're doing the research, you can genuinely call yourself a historian. If you don't have a degree in history, I don't have a degree in history. I have a master's, but my master's was in culinary arts, and it's covered way more than sort of the social cultural history element. That was one module that I studied. So I think, you know, it's being able to do the groundwork at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any, there's no magic. I mean, there probably are courses out there now, but I don't think there's any magic course you can go on that turns you into a food historian.
Not for food history. I don't think in Britain, really. Definitely not in Scotland.
It would be amazing, actually, to do that, to have a course on food history. But no, I think you're right, Sam. The difference is doing the primary research. I think if you're doing that, it doesn't matter. And as long as the research is like done diligently and with a passion for it, then I don't think you need to worry about qualifications. And I think food is an interesting space if we're talking about it academically, because there are, like in Scotland, there's a degree you can do in sort of gastronomy. You can do different things around the UK that are related to food in certain ways. You can obviously train to be a cook or a chef, but actually the study of food has never really been formalized in education.
No.
So it's a weird, again, it's almost going back to that idea of fuzziness and slipperiness. It's not quite, it's not like you can do the ABC of food history. So I don't think qualifications matter. And I say that as someone with a PhD.
So I suppose I wonder if you would be starting off your PhD in gingerbread with it being your first book. What brought you into studying and writing about gingerbread?
This is the joy of being an author. You pitch ideas to publishers and they go, yeah, we don't like that idea. So the original idea I pitched to Prospect Books, Catherine Kilgareth, who at the time ran Prospect Books, I think I pitched a book on forgotten fruits, and she went, oh, that's already been done. I don't really want to do that. And it was literally a threat. I love gingerbread, as you can imagine, given that I've written a book on it. But I've always loved gingerbread. I've always loved spices. And I sort of said to her as a throwaway comment, well, I've often wondered why no one's written a history of British gingerbreads. And she went, oh, I love that idea. Go away and do me a book proposal. And then I was suddenly like, oh, okay. That wasn't the answer I was expecting. But it was a hugely fun book to write because it was something I love, which is lucky because I had to write it during lockdown. So my family were a little less in love with gingerbread by the end of lockdown, because we ate an awful lot of gingerbread in lockdown. Not banana bread, it was gingerbread in our house.
Do you have a particular favourite type of gingerbread? Because it's something that varies quite dramatically.
Oh, yeah. I get asked this all the time about food. You're talking about food history. What's my favourite period? And this is a bit the same with gingerbread. Mm. It depends on my mood. So I'm quite partial to gingerbread and cheese, but for that I quite like a crisp gingerbread. Yes. So something like the parlies that I made when I came to the Scottish Food History Symposium earlier this year. But I do love a ginger cake, and the Focabuzz ginger cake that I've got in the book, which is a F. Marion McNeil book recipe, is, I think, one of my favourite gingerbreads because it contains fruit as well. I love dried fruit, so... But it's so moist and so absolutely delicious. I could eat that. I mean, I would eat that every day of the week for sure.
Yeah. It's also just an incredibly fun recipe to see. Focabers gingerbread. It fills the mouth in a very pleasing way before you've even bitten into it.
Yeah.
And that's actually quite a good tease for our next episode, which is going to be based around Focabers as well.
Oh, don't give it away, Lindsay. Don't give it away. Season 2, Focabers. So gingerbread, chocolate, saffron. What is next from Sam Bilton?
So actually, I'm not doing something on spices or exotic foods. I'm actually doing a book on food in Shakespeare.
Oh, wow. I love that. That's very cool.
So it's a collaboration with the Globe Theatre. So they've commissioned me to write a book based on food references in Shakespeare's plays. And I've taken 16th century and early 17th century recipes and done modern interpretations so that they can be reconstructed in a 21st century kitchen. So there are measurements, for example, which, as you both know, you don't get in the 16th and 17th centuries, or very rarely. So, yeah.
Do you have a favourite Shakespeare food illusion?
Oh, gosh. Do I have a favourite Shakespeare illusion? I've got a fondness for Falstaff because he's just so funny, but he eats and drinks everything. But particularly like his fondness for sherry, or sack, as he calls it. I don't know. Have I got a fondness? I don't know, because it's one of those things when you start looking at it and then you look at it compared to like what the sort of dietary manuals of the time were saying, you start to realise that some of the references aren't quite as innocent or as delicious as you might hope.
Yeah, there's lots of potentially saucy or rude stuff going on with some of the use of food as imagery.
Yeah, so some are quite obvious, like forked radishes, you know, we can all guess what that means, or was that what they're referring to there. You know, there's a line, I think, in Merry Wives of Windsor where Falstaff says, "Let the sky rain potatoes," which is obviously a reference to potatoes having aphrodisiac properties back, or that was as they were perceived back then, back in the 60s. We're talking mostly, I think, Spanish potatoes, which are like sweet potatoes.
Okay, right. So I had never heard
don't get me started on the medlars. The medlars, it's when it gets really... we start going off.
Quite not suitable for work. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. it was a really fascinating book to write and research. And it is a cookbook, so there's not so much of the historical narrative as there is in some of my other books, but it was still a hugely fun book to write. So, watch this space. I think it's out on October the 23rd this year.
Oh, I cannot wait. The thing that really stuck with me from your talk, amongst the variety of recipes that our listeners are about to hear and I want to try, is the misuse of the word banquet.
Yes.
I'm assuming, did that come from your Shakespeare research, or is this something that you've had with you as a historian?
Well, it's something I was aware of, and not so much the misuse of it, but or misinterpretation. I think misuse is a bit harsh, because Shakespeare would have been using it in the correct context. It's just that for modern people, we think of a banquet being a great big feast. But as a food historian, certainly dealing with that period, sort of late medieval through to probably mid 17th century, you're talking about a special course that appeared at the end of a meal. And it was, I sort of came across this, I suppose, in detail, looked at it in detail when I did the gingerbread book, because gingerbread used to be served as something that you would eat at the end of a meal as a digestive equivalent of a digestive to help with digestion, because ginger is very good for digestion. So it was a sweet course that was served after the feast, after the multi-course dinners that you'd had. And then it, but in certainly in the Elizabethan era, it was only, they were, because the ingredients were so expensive, it wasn't necessarily something that was open to everyone. So it was like the post-feast after party is how I like to phrase it, sort of post-feast present it. Is you go, yeah. You were, if you were someone special, you got invited to a banquet after dinner. And it was, but they were particularly renowned for being quite racy because they had a lot of ingredients that were associated with having aphrodisiac properties, like sugar, for example.
Yeah.
And most of the stuff on offer would have been sugary. So candied fruits, dried fruits, things like figs, that sort of thing. Gingerbread, which was made originally with honey and breadcrumbs and spices. So it was all, they were all sort of there to supposedly, if you, you know, sort of promote the sort of the, I think it's moist and warm humours of lust, Peter Brewer says when he describes it in his food in Tudor and Stuart England. So yeah, they were in Shakespeare's play, when you hear references to banquets, I'm not sure, I mean, I haven't seen the 1623 folio, but my interpretation in most of those scenes is they're referring to this special course. So in his play Henry VIII, for example, there is people are at a masque and they're talking about being really hot and bothered, and they go about to go into the banquet, which clearly wouldn't help them be less hot and bothered. They're eating them. And it's about, I guess it's a scene before, or as Henry's preparing to seduce or try to seduce Anne Boleyn. So, and I think there's a scene in Macbeth as well. I think that's where I brought it up.
Yeah.
There's a few food moments in Macbeth, but most of them don't have particularly pleasant connotations, like drugged possets and the rest of it.
You are not a stranger to Scotland, and I hope you are well prepared for the task that lies in front of you. But we're going to start with an easy one. Morning roll order. Sam, what is your type of roll and what is your filling?
Gosh. I don't know. I mean, I think you can't beat ham. But I'm talking
ham.
Proper ham, not like horrible slimy stuff you buy in a packet in the supermarket. I mean, like, a proper home-cooked ham, thickly sliced, lots of mustard. I'll eat that any time of day, to be fair.
That feels like a Boxing Day perfect little bite, a morning roll with ham.
Yeah.
And maybe just a little bit of, like, Dauphinoise sauce just drizzled over start.
Maybe, yeah, I'd go for that.
Lindsay, that sounds fantastic.
In terms of bread, Sam, do you prefer plain bread or pan bread?
I'd probably go pan bread.
I think
perfect.
That's fair.
Yeah.
If you were having porridge, what are you having?
Actually, I quite like golden syrup.
Oh, yeah. Delicious.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, it has to be made with milk as well. I mean, I do... I have in the past when I've been sort of watching waistlines and stuff, had like with water or half and half, but it's got to be made with milk. And then golden syrup, not too much, but golden syrup,
delicious. In terms of tonics products, do you prefer a caramel log, a caramel wafer, or the classic tea cake?
Oh, tea cake, no brainer.
I feel like I may have led you on that one, but
I know. I have no problem with the other products, but tea cake every day of the week.
If you were going to add a family recipe into a national cookery book, what family recipe would it be? And it can be an English one as well.
Well, I'm assuming it is going to be a Scottish one. So another thing that I miss from living in Scotland was stovies, and I'm not sure. I mean, we used to have it at school. I was at school, I used to have school dinners, and I really miss stovies. I don't think I've had it since I left. I've never made it myself.
Hold on, Sam, because you were in the Northeast. So did you have your stovies with beetroot and an oat cake?
No, it was at school. So they wouldn't have. I'm not sure I would have eaten the beetroot. I had a thing against beetroot when I was that age, because I was once, my aunt gave me too much pickled beetroot and I was violently sick. I didn't touch it till I was probably in my 30s. So I don't remember any oat cakes either at school. I think it was just stovies, which I absolutely adored.
And what was the, was it like a sort of shredded meat? What was the kind of protein consistency?
I'm not sure there was much protein in it, Lindsay, to be honest. I think it was mostly gravy, probably left over from the school dinner the day before, and potatoes. But it was bloody lovely.
Mm.
It's delicious. Yeah, we've had a lot of Stovey's discourse on the podcast so far, so it's we find it's a point of contention with some people. Okay, do you have an ingredient in your kitchen that you are reach for all the time when you're cooking? What's your favourite ingredient, your go-to?
Oh, well, it's probably going to be a spice, but it's really hard to say which one I go to most. I mean, obviously pepper's a bit boring, but I do use a lot of pepper. In terms of it's quite obvious because everyone has salt and pepper, and I don't think, but I have so many different varieties of pepper, it's ridiculous in my kitchen. So probably pepper, if I had to. If it's
perfect.
Yeah, if something that I use regularly, yeah.
Perfect.
Something that I think is, I always think that white pepper for some reason feels very Scottish to me. I don't know why.
I think it's
just like a.
Yeah, the flavour of it is always in Scotch broth, quite often in Stovey's.
Yeah.
It's that like special spiciness. Yeah, I always associate it with my granny's cooking white pepper.
You should try it in shortbread. It's really lovely in shortbread.
Oh, okay. We've got a recipe for next week, Lindsay. Do you have a favourite Scottish word?
Oh.
We've had numpty, ugh. We've had
well, I don't know why the first one that popped into my head was bampot, but I don't know if that's definitely
that's great. That's definitely Scottish, and that's perfect.
When we moved to Scotland, when we moved up from Essex, and my dad had been working in where he worked in Ellen for a while, and one of the chaps there used to ask him if he had any quines or loons, and my dad was like, "That's really impertinent." I know I might have a lunatic in my household. And then someone explained to him that he meant girls or boys. I'm quite partial to the word quine. Quine, is that right?
Quine's good. It's very northeast. Like, I would never get called a quine down here.
No.
But when I go home, it's, all right, quine?
Yeah.
And I think the last question we have is, can you remember what the first job you were given in the kitchen was?
Oh, yeah, I was probably making bird's trifle. Which just sounds awful, doesn't it? Because I'm sure people would be absolutely horrified.
No, not at all.
But actually,
I love bird's custard.
I interviewed someone for my MA when I did my dissertation, and an academic, and she was saying, you know, people are very dismissive of things like birds trifle, but she said actually it does teach you the sort of basic cooking skills, because you still had to make, well, back in my day anyway, you still had to make the custard, albeit with a powder, but you still had to heat your milk and everything, and then you had to make sure the layers were set, and I mean, it's not like cooking something from scratch, but per se, but equally it's when you're teaching a kid, you know, my mum would let me just make the bird's trifle. I wasn't supervised. It was, you know, as long as you could read the instructions, she figured you couldn't really go far wrong.
I feel like that's a really good one in teaching, like, patience, because as you say, if you don't let your jelly set or you don't let your custard set, you're just going to end up with a big bowl of mush. But I always thought bird's custard powder was quite magical because it's sort of pink and you're like, and then you get this beautiful yellow custard. I was entranced by it as a child.
That sounds absolutely delicious. So, Sam, thank you very much for coming along and joining us today. Where can the people find you?
So, I've got a website, sambilton.com, where you'll find links to my social media, but I'm also on Instagram and Blue Skies, Mrs. Bilton, that's with two S's, so Mrs. S. Bilton. And you can find Comfortably Hungry on your favourite podcast platform.
Listen, Sam, thank you so very much for coming along today. It's been an absolute treat. We hope to see you soon at some sort of festival, or whenever we all win awards together next.
Definitely.
I can't wait to have a historic cocktail and catch up.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. Thank you.
A lovely ginger wine-based cocktail, perhaps. We merge all of our interests.
Ginger aid.
So, Lindsay, you've not actually heard this talk, have you, yet?
I haven't. I'm so excited. We were in different rooms for the day of the symposium, so it meant I missed out on half the talks and, yeah, haven't heard back yet. So, really looking forward to it. I love gingerbread, and Sam's history is always really, really good.
We had, it was quite, it was an intimate gathering we had for, in the second room, and it was all kind of like tea tastings, demonstrations. We had Sam talked about gingerbread, and I talked about the history of the Scottish Women's Rural Institute. So we do have, you can, a couple of times she throws to me to read out Scottish things. Sam has spent time in Scotland, but is very English, and called upon me to use my dulcet tones to read out some phrases. And I do have a wee interjection when she asks if anyone knows why gingerbread molds. She found a gingerbread mold that had a chicken wearing trousers and was stumped. Oh. And I had a hypothesis. So you can listen along to that. You can listen along to that just now.
Hello everyone, and welcome to my very, very brief overview of the history of gingerbread. So you probably realise that gingerbread has a really, really long history in around the world really, but in Europe certainly, and in this country. And today I'm going to say, give you a very, very brief overview, because it goes back hundreds of years. My background, I'm a food historian, and I also edit a journal called Petit Propos Culinaire, and which is a journal that deals with food history, cookery books, food culture generally, recently acquired by Equinox. And I also have a podcast, which is a food history podcast called Comfortably Hungry, and I've written several books, very niche, my first of which was on the history of gingerbread. And then I wrote one on saffron, and I've written one on chocolate, getting less niche. And I've got one coming out shortly on food in Shakespeare. So that's a bit about me. So if we go on to the next slide. I also ought to apologise for my bad pronunciation of Scottish words. I'm saying this as you can tell from my accent, although I have lived in Scotland when I was tiny. I haven't acquired a Scottish accent, as you can probably hear. So I am going to absolutely murder your beautiful language. So I apologise in advance. So first of all, are we fans of gingerbread?
Yes.
Yeah? And how would you define it? I said to you, how would you define gingerbread? What would you say gingerbread is?
Spicy.
Spicy, yeah. Sticky, yeah, sometimes, yeah.
Coarse crumb,
yeah. I mean, the thing with gingerbread is that it comes in various shapes and sizes. So should it be like crisp, like a biscuit? We're going to have a variety shortly that is very much crisp like a biscuit. Or should it be cakey? Should it be crumbly, or made indeed from crumbs, as we shall see? And in the spicing element, what should those spices be? Because this is something that can be quite controversial. So this is the Oxford, and actually I think there might be another definition under it. This is the Oxford, because I'm in Scotland, I wanted to make sure there were some Scottish references in this presentation. This is the Oxford Companion to Foods definition of gingerbread. Now, normally, to me, suggests that it's not always the case. It says normally it's spice with ginger. But I can tell you, for example, depending on where you are, and even in the British Isles, if you go to Wales, they have a gingerbread, which is literally, the name translates as gingerbread or ginger cake without ginger, because it has no ginger in it, even though it's known as a gingerbread. And if you go to Europe, a lot of European gingerbreads don't contain ginger. For example, in Sweden, they have a gingerbread, a ginger snap, which is flavoured with cardamom. So it's not always a given that gingerbread should contain ginger. And this is the definition, this is actually from the Scottish Language Dictionary for gingerbread. So I said, I didn't say I was going to murder your beautiful language. And it says something about it relates to things being showy, gaudy, extravagant. That makes reference to the fanciful gilding of it, which I will come on to. These are just some of the Scottish gingerbreads that were mentioned by Florence Marion McNeill in her wonderful book. I'm so pleased they're actually reissuing that. It really does deserve, and I'm astounded when people haven't heard of her. So I'm going to have to sort of read from my notes here about the different ones, because I'm not up on all of them. But the first one, Anchorstock, is, McNeill says it's a large rye-based loaf. And this, again, is going to illustrate how different, even in one country, gingerbreads can be. She said it was particularly associated, it's seasoned with spice and currants. It was traditionally baked for New Year or Christmas. And I should have actually asked you how to pronounce this word, because I am going to mispronounce the title of this book, something terrible. In the Life of Mansi Wach? Wach? By David Moyer. He writes about mussel in Anchorstocks being sliced for tea drinkings and posset cups. Posset was, we think of it now as a dessert, but it was more like a drink, sort of, that separated into sort of almost like curds and whey in a way. So, so that has a long history up here. Then there's, I'm going to also pronounce this badly, Fochabers gingerbread, which is, which is, I think, my favourite Scottish gingerbread. Unfortunately, I didn't bring that one today. I say, well, it's my favourite. I'm going to contradict myself shortly, because I know we're coming on to Bruni as well, which is also one of my favourites. But that's made with beer and spices. And I really, when I wrote my book, I absolutely love that recipe and make it regularly, because it's such a wonderfully moist cake, packed with fruit. I love fruit cake anyway. Then we have Bruni, which we have some here. And I want you to go out, when you leave here later, I want you to tell everyone what they missed. you can do, actually. I was going to save it to the end, but you can do. Now, this is an oatmeal-based gingerbread, and it's the first one that McNeill says she ever collected from, so she said, at the age of 5 or 6. I think she was tremendously, had a tremendous gift of foresight to realise that she was going to become a food historian or write about Scottish food history. She actually had to ask a friend, because her friend used to bring it to school every day as her midday piece. And she said to her, and I've paraphrased this, but she said, you know, what's in it? And she said, there's treacle in it, there's sugar, there's a little flour, oatmeal. McNeill's recipe actually is bound with buttermilk. And it actually doesn't have that much treacle in it. I was quite surprised, but McNeill says she managed to work out the proportions later and put the recipe in her book. And this is, as I say, one of my favourite gingerbreads. I particularly like this with cheese or banana. So not together, cheese and banana. That might be a bit weird. She also adds, actually, another historian noted that Yule Brunies were composed of rye meal rather than oatmeal, and that they were formed in a round and the edges were pinched to look like a sun. So that, you know, again shows that there's variations even within a small locality. There's Parleys, which I will discuss later. They're a type of ginger snap. I have some of those here. And there were Sweetie Foals, which she said were flat round gingerbreads, about 3 inches in diameter, decorated with sweetie carvies, which were coloured caraway confits, that's caraway seeds coated in sugar. And they were popular at the Lammas Market in Kirkwall. And there's Kirriemuir gingerbread, which is up there, which I gather is quite new, but someone might want to dissuade me of that notion. It was first made by Walter Burnett in East Kilbride in the 1940s. Now, what I find interesting is that obviously when we have people emigrate to other parts of the world and they want to take their dishes or their food culture with them, it's interesting how they then interpret things like gingerbread. And there was one chap called James Thompson who in the mid-19th century actually bemoaned the fact that he couldn't get decent oats in Canada, for example, so he couldn't make wonderful bannocks or oat cakes. So he used to get his former boss from Aberdeen to send him gingerbread because he basically said the gingerbread in Canada was horrible. Sorry, if anyone's Canadian or has Canadian connections, I apologize. I'm not saying it's horrible. I'm just repeating what this chap said. And he said that the gingerbread he got shipped in from Scotland was far superior. And it actually, he had some in April and it stayed good till Christmas. And I think that's the thing with gingerbread. It does keep well. Some gingerbreads, not all, but things. This is the Bruni that you're eating now. This is a bit like a Parkin. So I made this a few days ago, but generally speaking, things like Parkin improve with age. So it's interesting that he reckoned he had gingerbread kept over 6 months. In fact, yeah, like 8 months, and then it was better. So where did gingerbread originate? Well, the short answer is nobody really knows. It's one of those sort of QI questions that people say, where did it originate? There's lots of theories. Some say it originated in China. That it was, you know, Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan. Well, somebody's troops carried it into battle. It all seems highly speculative in that respect. Some say it was sort of like Persia, that sort of area. We don't really know where it originated. We know there were honey cakes, but my feeling is it probably owes its incarnation, if you like, as a dessert. It started in the apothecary rather than in the kitchen. Now, there's reasons for this. Ginger, it was renowned for being something that could comfort the stomach. So you take it to ease digestion. Confucius repeatedly ate ginger before every meal. So it's possible that it was originally developed as a means to aid digestion. And if we click on the next description, this is an early 15th century recipe. Now, there were probably recipes before this, but this is one of the few that has been written down. Now, as it says, it is take a quart of honey, you sieve it, skim it clean, you add saffron, pepper, then you add bread, there's cinnamon in it. Anything that isn't in it that you can see that's obvious?
Ginger.
Now, some people say this is a transcription error, that whoever wrote the recipe down wrote it down incorrectly and that there should be ginger in it. Now, what I will say to that, there were two problems with that. First of all, paper, as it was, vellum, was incredibly expensive. Not to mention the fact that the spices were in the actual good that is being described was very expensive. I think you would have been absolutely torn to shreds if you'd been making transcription errors. Secondly, I've tried this mixture and I can assure you that when you taste it, and I do it lots of talks and stuff and demos, if I give people gingerbread made to this recipe and they eat it and I tell them without showing them the recipe what's in it, the first thing they say is ginger, because you get the heat from the pepper, you've got the spice, the warming spice of the cinnamon, and the saffron, it all combines to make a very gingery tasting good. It may just be that whoever devised this recipe didn't have access to ginger for whatever reason, they couldn't get it from, or maybe they didn't like it, I don't know. We'll never know. So I think, you know, it's interesting to see how gingerbread has evolved and why they say it doesn't necessarily have to have ginger in it. My description of gingerbread is, in terms of its history, I like to see it as the Blackadder of baked goods. So when gingerbread starts out, it's eaten by the higher echelons of society. It's a proper top-end luxury good. We heard about luxury teas earlier. This is right up there, although we didn't have tea back then, unfortunately, or not in Britain. It was using incredibly expensive, valuable products. So by combining, I mean, I often think the person that actually decided they were going to combine all these incredibly expensive spices, mix them with honey and breadcrumbs, and then sort of dry it out in the oven and then decorate it with gold leaf, that was taking a huge risk. Now, luckily, it tasted great, but can you imagine if it didn't, or if someone didn't like it? I mean, you've been wasting huge amounts of money. So it was initially eaten as I said, sort of more of a digestive. It was served generally at the end of a meal as part of something in the medieval period called the void or the wadé. And it was served alongside spiced wine, hippocras, which is sweetened wine, a bit like mulled wine, but it's served cold. And it's called that because you pass it through a conical sort of shaped, sieve's a bit strong, it was not as stiff as that, but shaped sleeve or bag, like a jelly bag that we would use nowadays, which is supposed to resemble Hippocrates' sleeve. I don't quite know how they know Hippocrates had sleeves shaped like that, but that's where the name Hippocras comes from. And we do know that, for example, in 1530, the Duke of Athol was served gingerbread to King James V. It's listed in one of the dishes that was served to King James V after a post-hunting sort of expedition. So it's, you know, it's at this stage in the medieval period, it's not everyone's eating gingerbread. It's not common like it is nowadays. Now, one of the things with gingerbread, especially when we get to the 16th century, this wadé, this meal that's served, so it's served at the end of the meal. So you've had your various courses, your various rich dishes. You go to this course, which becomes known as the banquet, which gets rather confusing because people think of banquets being large feasts. It's not a large feast. It's a specific sweet course that we're supposed to serve to, in theory, help digestion. But by the 16th century, they're getting a slightly more louche reputation, shall we say, the banquets. Because at the end of the day, you're combining, we're now starting to see the use of sugar increasing. So sugar is beginning to sort of replace honey as the main sweetener. And sugar is moist and hot in terms of humoral theory. And when it was combined with spices, which were also hot, they were essentially ingredients to encourage the humours of lust. So these banquets were, so you might have a big feast, you've got hundreds, maybe not hundreds, say you've got 100 people, a small amount may be invited to a banquet. And by the time you get to sort of the late 16th, early 17th century, they were constructing separate rooms to serve this. So it's like the post-feast after party. So it's a bit like being at the Oscars. If you got invited, you were in, you know, you were someone special. You can imagine someone like Henry VIII having one of these and, you know, inviting the future Anne Boleyn or any number of other wives that you can think of going forward after Catherine of Aragon. So they were very much seen as a place that, well, you could get up to things away from the prying eyes of perhaps people that you weren't so respectful of or servants, and they would lay out lots of sweet treats. So as well as having gingerbread, there would be candied fruits, there would be generally sort of sweet things, I've mentioned the comfits and things like that before. And it was, you say, they gained this really sort of louche reputation. There was a chap called Philip Stubbs, who was a pamphleteer in the late 16th century, I think. Might be actually slightly into the 17th century. And he used to write things, you know, comment on practices of the day. And he was particularly anti-banquets and banqueting houses because he felt that, you know, this was where the nefarious goings on went on, particularly if you were a woman. So he actually wrote I'm going to read it out because it is quite amusing. He writes in this pamphlet that in the suburbs of the city, women have gardens either paled or walled round about very high with their arbours and bowers fit for the purpose. lest they might be espied in those open places. They have their banqueting houses with galleries, turrets, and whatnot, therein sumptuously erected, wherein they may, and doubtless do, play the filthy persons. Note, he says women. The men are excluded from this. I mean, of course, they had nothing to do with the filthy goings-on. Stubbs, it has to be said, wasn't a barrel of laughs. He was also against fancy hats, going to the theatre, dancing, basically having fun. So you can imagine he probably wasn't getting invited to a banquet anyway. So enough said on that. So it was, banquets also became a useful setting for in drama, because people would have these associations with them as being places that were, you know, sort of a bit sort of where dodgy things went on, particularly when it comes to revenge in plays. So, for example, Macbeth sees Banquo's ghost at a banquet. Now, most people interpret that, really, who don't understand food history perhaps, that the banquet means a feast, but chances are it probably means it. I written in the time it was, the banquet would have meant a standalone, this standalone course. So, yes, beware of going to the banquet. As we go through the centuries, we're going to see that gingerbread becomes more democratic. So we go from Blackadder to Baldric being able to eat it. And if you were Baldric, the place that you were most likely to get your gingerbread was probably at your fair. So it's still, let's not kid ourselves, still even into the 18th and probably early 19th century, it's still a treat. It's not something we're eating every day and dunking in our tea or chocolate, as it probably would have been then. And one of the reasons for these is a change of ingredients. And the key change is to use the move away from honey or pure sugar to using treacle. Now, treacle is a byproduct of the sugar processing industry. It was initially used as a, these are obviously modern cans of treacle, but it was originally used by, again, apothecaries. And the term treacle comes from Thieraca and Antidota, I think, if I got that right, which meant cure for the bite of a mad bell, a wild beast. And it was used as the treacle electuary, which was originally honey, admittedly, not treacle as we think of it, had a variety of spices put in it, and it was a cure-all for just about anything from bites of, from beasts to syphilis, probably. I mean, they just gave it, it was just generally, if you needed medicine, you had treacle. But as the sugar processing, you know, we expanded our colonies, or invaded different countries, and we started growing sugar, and sugar became more widely available. We had an excess of treacle. Some of it obviously was used in making rum. I'm not an expert on rum making, but some of it was still used. It replaced honey in the electuaries. So it was, you've got Venetian treacle and London treacle. And then there was the excess. Some people worked out, clever people, that it was, you know, could be used in cooking. So we moved from having treacle as purely something that was medicinal. And you could understand why initially when people were thinking it as a medicine, they're perhaps like, oh, has it got a culinary application? But it quickly jumped from the apothecary into the kitchen. Now, what we start to see is recipes appearing where treacle is being used. And actually, gingerbread now, we're moving into the sort of the 18th century. This is more like gingerbread we know and love today. So it's, now we're getting rid of the breadcrumbs. You still see sort of in the late 17th century, Robert May, for example, who wrote The Accomplished Cook, which came out around 1660s-ish, sort of restoration period. He still uses breadcrumbs, but we're starting to move away from honey and towards treacle because, as I say, it was much cheaper to use. This recipe here is from Elizabeth Clellan, who was, in her day, a famous Scottish cookery writer. Hers is quite typical of the recipes that you find of the time. It's interesting that she has the Dutch gingerbread underneath it, actually. But her recipe at the top is very similar to the ones that you see appearing in the late 17th century into the early 18th century. Cleland was quite interesting because while she certainly didn't have, you know, was not the first cookbook to be published in Scotland, she probably was, her day, the most successful. And it went on to have several publications or several re-editions of the book. And Walter Scott evidently had a copy, a first edition in his collection. So as I said, if you weren't making it at home, it was still, I'm talking about it as being quite commonplace, but again, you still need quite a lot of money to make gingerbread. You'd still need to be able to afford the treacle and the spices as well. So if you weren't, and you didn't have ovens at home as well, so there's not, it wasn't a case of everyone had an oven, they could just quickly whip up a batch of gingerbread. You would have to go somewhere to buy it. And as I said, the place you would probably go is your local fair. Now, when you went to a fair, you get gingerbread. They were printed in elaborate moulds. You were saying you'd seen Peter Breers's moulds. These are from Ivan Day's website. He has some spectacular moulds, and they're these gingerbread figures, which are all kings and queens, are massive. Most people probably weren't buying massive gingerbreads, but the moulds were carved into wood, very intricate. Interestingly, kings and queens would be repurposed for future kings and queens because it was quite a skill and obviously I imagine quite expensive to carve these pieces of wood. So they would just reuse them and just say, oh, it's the next George particularly, because this rings to mind because there were quite a number of those in the 18th century. And the funniest one or the oddest one I've come across is of a chicken wearing trousers. Now, I don't know why the chicken's wearing trousers. I have, in my research, I could not find out the meaning behind it. Do you know?
There was a move after the Reformation that you couldn't represent things that were in heaven or earth. So there was things like demons, dragons, and bastardised things that you found in nature. So it would be okay with the new Reformed Church.
Wow. That's amazing. I didn't know that. So that makes total sense as well. It makes more sense than some of the explanations that have been offered to me before about the chicken wearing trousers. I'm afraid I don't have a picture of that because my picture of the chicken wearing trousers was taken through glass. They actually have a mould in Horsham Museum, which is where not far from where I live in Sussex. So these moulds, as I say, were very detailed. I mean, these are the most elaborate. And you would go to a fair and buy a piece of gingerbread, which was known as a fairing. It was considered good luck to buy gingerbread from a fair. But interestingly, they will come on to some of the reputations of people selling the gingerbread. Walter Scott wrote that his son Charles attended a fair in 1819, and as he said, he made himself sick with eating gingerbread, whereby he came to his disgrace. So I'm not quite sure what the disgrace was, but so it was, it was a proper thing to do. I might actually give Peter to read this because I really am too embarrassed to.
Well,
it's not in Gaelic. It's just this paragraph. So this is again from the Life of Mansi.
Here we go. Best Scottish impression. Right. Six penny and shilling cakes in paper tied with skinny and roundabouts and snaps, browned in white quality and parliaments on stands covered with calendared linen, clean from the fold. To pass, it was just impossible. It set my teeth a-watering, and I scurried like mad until I had a gilded lady thrust into my little nave. 50 Shades of Gingerbread. In which, after admiring for a minute, I applied my teeth to, and of the head I made no bones, so that in less than no time she had vanished, petticoats and all, no trace of her being to the fore, save and except long treacly daubs extending east and west from ear to ear and north to south, from Cape Neb of the nose to the extremely of the bearded land.
Thank you. So, I mean, I say the gingerbread, there was a phrase to lick the gilt off the gingerbread. So apparently people would buy, or kids would buy, these wonderfully moulded gingerbreads that were gilded with, it should be said, by this stage, it wasn't gold. It was like a fake gold that was made from zinc and something else that just looked like gold. It's called Dutch, I think, known as Dutch gold. So it wasn't actually... might be, I don't know, but it's zinc and something else. I'd have to look back at my notes, but it wasn't real gold. I mean, I guess there were, in certain circles, they were like kings and queens. This sort of thing was still being made for noble tables. This isn't necessarily what you were getting at a fair, but yeah, you would apparently lick the gold decoration off and then nibble at your gingerbread. Yeah, yeah. So you're taking the glitzy bit, which, if we go back to the original definition, or what in the Scots language dictionary, that's what they're when they talk about something being showy and being gingerbread. That's what they mean. It used to be quite showy and elaborate. So we move on to the next slide. So generally speaking, being a seller of gingerbread was not considered to be a good career. So Ben Jonson in 1604 wrote a play called Bartholomew Fair. He has a character in his play called Joan Trash. Kind of says it all, even back in 1604. And she is accused of selling gingerbread that is made with stale bread, rotten eggs, musty ginger, and dead honey. Although she protests that it's nothing but what's wholesome in her gingerbread. And she, there's scenes where she gets accused of selling a basket of potpourri because... She was selling idols effectively. That's the Puritan pastor who's attacking her is basically accusing her of that. So I say it wasn't necessarily deemed to be a worthy career. Now, there are some exceptions, and I'm afraid I couldn't find a Scottish one, so you'll have to forgive me. This relates to a seller in London called a Tiddy Doll. And I'm also not going to do Tiddy Doll's song, which gave him his name, because you really don't want to hear me singing. But he got the name because he used to sing a little ditty to advertise his gingerbread that went something like Tiddy, 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 Tiddy Doll, and hence the name Tiddy Doll. But we talked about earlier, or Kevin talked earlier about Philip Harbin and his look. Tiddy had a distinct look. He wore a ruffled shirt and he had a tricorn hat with a massive feather in the top. So he was easily identifiable, and he was sort of quite legendary in sort of 18th century London. So much so that he decided to go on holiday once, and rumour went around the city that he'd been murdered because he disappeared. He'd just gone on his holiday. He just fancied a change of scenery. He came back a couple of weeks later, and he was sort of quite amazed that everyone had been sort of mourning him. Unfortunately, he actually did get murdered later in 1752 because he was carrying a lot of money because he evidently did quite well out of his gingerbread business. But his legend lived on, so much so that James Gilray was inspired to use Tiddy Doll as the inspiration for this depiction of Napoleon. Note the tricorn hat with the big feather, shoveling gingerbread kings and queens into an oven. So there you go. Sad thing with oven, in fact, obviously got murdered, but the thing with gingerbread sellers is that they actually got a reputation for spending all their money on gin. So, you know, that's it wasn't considered to be a very reputable career. There were various gimmicks they would use to sell their gingerbread. So they used to do gingerbread lotteries there was one game this chap Daniel Cleary used to run where he would walk around with a box with like holes in it and the doll's head would pop up. And if you pick the number where the doll's head popped up, you got 100 gingerbread nuts. But if you didn't, you still got 7. But his gingerbread nuts, so he claimed, was so, so nice. And so, so hot and spicy that if you won 100, they were much smaller than the other 7 because they were far superior than anything you would have got from even Tiddy Doll. So I'm not sure the customer was getting a good deal there. Now, gingerbread nuts are so-called. We've heard of ginger nut biscuits, haven't we? Yeah. Because they are rolled, there's no nuts in them. They are rolled into the size of a walnut before you bake them. I don't know whether I've got a, I do have a picture there. That's what they end up looking like when they're cooked, so they spread out. But that's where the gingerbread nut name comes from, because they look like ginger nut, a nut size, but when they go in the oven. These ones are actually flavoured with caraway. Sometimes they have mixed peel in them as well. Now, the other type of gingerbread that was popular at this time were ginger snaps. And the one that is particularly well known in Scotland are the parlies. So I don't know whether we want to leave these to the end or... So they are the square biscuits at the front there, where you can probably see on the plate. Made with treacle, very crisp, as you will see. Hopefully, they stay crisp. I made them the day before yesterday. These were particularly renowned for being sold at in Edinburgh around the Parliament area, near Parliament Square. At Mrs. Flockhart's Tavern. Now, I'm not sure Mrs. Flockhart's Tavern was a real place. I'm looking at you, Peter.
As far as I'm aware, it was.
It was real.
It was the nearest tavern to the entrance of Parliament.
Okay, so it was real. I wasn't, because I know she does, I think she is mentioned by Walter Scott, so I wasn't sure whether it was another... Meg Dodds mentions snaps as well, but she was entirely fictitious. So, and sometimes... McNeil tells us that they were decorated with Glasgow jam, which is apparently hundreds and thousands. Again, I'm looking at you because I'd never heard...
I've never heard of Glasgow jam. I'm immediately going to research this.
I'm quoting McNeil. I'm not making this up. So, right, so this one I will try... I'm going to have to put my glasses on. Sorry, I can't read. Otherwise, it'll be worse than my Scottish accent if I try and do it without glasses. So this is Robert Chambers' description about these parlies in terms of where they were available. Each forenoon was this place, this is Mrs. Blockhart's Tavern, or at least all in front of the screen, put into the neatest order at the same time, three bottles, severally containing brandy, rum and whiskey, were placed on a bunker seat in the window of the hotel, and that's in inverted commas, flanked by a few glasses and a salver of gingerbread biscuits. About noon, anyone watching the place from an opposite window would have observed an elderly gentleman entering the humble shop, where he saluted the lady with a "How do you do, ma'am?" then passed into the side space to indulge himself with a glass or two from one of the other bottles. After him came another, who went through the same ceremonial, and after him another again, and so on. Strange to say that these were men of importance in society, some of them lawyers in good employment, some bankers and so forth, and so all of them inhabitants of good houses in George Square. It was in passing to or from the forenoon business in town that they thus regaled themselves. So these biscuits were sort of gained a reputation, or got their name from being associated with that part of Edinburgh. But the reality is, I think it's probably just a ginger snap biscuit that has been adopted from. So what about gingerbread today? So even when we go to the turn of the 20th century, people like Frederick Rhine, who wrote a book on saleable shop goods. So he was doing he wrote a book that if you were a baker, you could get recipes in and gave you details. Instructions or the sizes and the rest, but he was bemoaning the fact that gingerbread wasn't what it used to be. They used to, for example, leave the gingerbread dough for several weeks sometimes to mature. That didn't happen anymore. And the molded gingerbreads were falling out of fashion. They were being replaced by machine-made sort of gingerbread men that we know today and love. And then we had the First World War, and actually one of the sad things that happened in that period is that we lost a lot of the knowledge to carve these moulds, died out. The practice, it was already going out of fashion, but a lot of that knowledge died quite literally in the war, either from old age or they were killed. So the knowledge didn't get passed on. And as a consequence, you know, gingerbread hasn't gone away, but it has evolved, as things always do. And it was interesting what John was saying earlier about from Pico Teas, about the, you know, we don't drink tea, the younger generation don't drink tea so much. Ginger nuts, even from writing this book, which was published in 2020, have gone down. They were, I think, in the top 10 still when I wrote the book. They were only number 18 or 19, I discovered the other day. So the popularity of sort of what I would say a more classic gingerbread is still declining. But of course, you can go into any cafe or bakery and you'll be able to buy a generic gingerbread man. So I do have some hope that it will still be preserved for years to come.
So that was the talk. We will be uploading over the next few weeks. Hopefully if we can... Let me just say, Lindsay, each one of the talks is about 180 gigabytes of video and audio. My poor little computer can't take it, so we're going to try and find someone to help us editing them and getting them uploaded so we can share them for everyone to follow along, to catch up on. But yes, this is us for this week.
I know. And whilst it is... you know, your computer's being challenged, just that's so much delicious food history for people to look forward to that will be coming their way. So Absolutely. Yes, that was us this week. Amazing to hear from Sam, and join us next week where we'll be talking about another great Scottish food product.
Do you want to tease it anymore? No, just in case.
I put it this way, for anyone who knows me, it's a topic that's quite close to my heart in a number of ways.
Okay, stay tuned everyone for next week.
The Scottish Food History Podcast is hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist, and we would like to thank Sam Bilton for joining us this week, and also Scotland Food and Drink for the sponsorship of our symposium.
The Scottish Food History Podcast is produced by Tenement Kitchen.